Time to turn our attention to climate and weather concerns. Professor Steve Ackerman with me now in the studio. He's the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. And Professor John Martin will be joining us. I guess he's probably finishing up a class he's teaching.
He's probably finishing up right now, getting ready to run over here.
All right. John's the chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. So great to have them with us again. And certainly I hope if you have a climate or weather question, you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Lots to talk about. I know tornadoes are on a lot of people's minds with this past weekend.
Yeah, there was a pretty bad tornado down in the Mississippi area, and a number of them actually in that area. It's their season for it, so...
And our season is coming up.
Our season is generally kind of starts in May, but we get a peak number of tornadoes in late June is generally when we get most of ours.
How does a tornado form?
Good question. And we can tell you the necessary but not necessarily sufficient conditions, which means we don't fully understand. The ingredients that we know we need is warm, moist air near the ground, mm-hmm. cooler, drier air up above. And the importance of that is that once you lift that air up, that warm, moist air near the ground, once you lift it up a little bit, if you have cold or drier air above, then it becomes much less dense and buoyant, and then it can just take off. And then the other thing we need is vertical wind shear, or a change in wind speed and or directions with height. Those are two of the important ingredients in order to get tornadoes.
And I don't know if you saw the strength of those tornadoes, but they had to have been, the one at least, had to have been pretty strong.
Yeah, we rate those on the enhanced Fujita scale, which is based on the damage that they do. And last that I had heard, after the official assessment, so, you know, the professionals go out and look at the damage, and initially it was set at an EF3, and the maximum you can be is an EF4, EF5, I'm sorry. But I had seen some emails suggesting that they actually may be moving it up into a higher category of EF4, which is, you know, pretty destructive.
And it certainly did a lot of damage.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these cases where it did a lot of damage and is wide enough. I think it was on the order of a mile long that when it's all over, you can go on satellite imagery and actually see the scar on the land.
And it went for a mile.
It went for, a little over a mile, I think. No, it went more than a mile. I think it was like a mile wide.
A mile wide?
Yeah, I think it was about a mile wide. Oh. One of them. So pretty destructive.
Oh, man. Again, if you can join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Take questions about tornadoes, but, of course, all other kinds of weather questions as well, or climate questions, and please feel free to join in. What's the record for? Do you know the record for the most tornadoes in Wisconsin?
We are just coming out of Tornado Awareness Week in Wisconsin last week. So, yes, I know all these facts that I'm going to forget in about a month. But the record number was 62 in 2005. That's the most we've had in the state. Our average is about 21.
Okay, so 60. Boy, that's a lot.
That's a lot. That's three times what we would normally expect.
So are we, when you compare us to other states, Oklahoma probably is one of those states that's a lot higher.
Yeah, there's the Tornado Alley, which is Oklahoma, Kansas, parts of Texas, and parts of Nebraska that get the most, the most severe tornadoes in particular.
And so they have the more likely to have those conditions?
Yeah, right. They're more likely to have those conditions because they're, they get a lot of southerly flow that makes its way up from the Gulf Stream, from the Gulf of Mexico, which is a good ingredient. You have that southerly flow brings in that warm, moist air. And then up above, you have air coming from the west. So they get the shear and the moist conditions near the surface.
So they could have hundreds.
I don't know how many they have. That's a good question. I'm quite certain it's more than 21. 68 might be a light year for them.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, our guest, John Martin, will be joining us soon as we talk with him about climate and weather. Well, the weather in the state right now, is it pretty normal for this time?
Actually, it's hard to believe given this last weekend when it seemed kind of chilly. But on average, we are entire state is about 5 to 6 degrees above normal for the month of April. So we've had a pretty warm April. And a pretty dry one again. I'm going to restate that. For the northern part of Wisconsin, again, it was pretty dry, unfortunately. The southern part, we were actually a little bit above normal in terms of precipitation.
Oh, we were?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, that surprises me.
Me too.
Because I it just seemed like we had not had any rain.
Yeah, yeah. But it just goes to show, you can't trust your memory. You got to go to the data. Because I thought for sure we were going to be colder than normal.
Let's take some calls here. Bud and Wausau's just come up here, so we'll go to Bud. Hi, Bud. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I lived in the country. We had 7 acres in Wisconsin, which is not real prone to tornadoes, but we had a garden, and I needed a root cellar anyway, so out of the basement, I took some of the basement blocks out of the wall, and I outside, I dug down about 7 feet, about the size of a grave, a little bigger, and I did it by hand. I'd never do it by hand again, even though it was sand country. A backhoe could do it in a half an hour. I worked about a day and sweat terribly doing it, but it was good exercise when I was younger. But anyway, I always swore that if I lived in any kind of tornado country like Oklahoma or any of those states, boy, I would dig a root cellar and I would put it to use for other things. But in the meantime, when a tornado came, I would get into that thing. And I know if a person built one, it shouldn't cost. If you put a concrete slab across the top at about ground level and just build it out of a cement block and put a real heavy 2x4 door getting into it from your basement, goodness, your family would be safe, and it could be used for if you had a garden or for other things in the meantime. But I would just like to throw that suggestion out, and it wouldn't be that expensive for folks to do that down in those areas, especially if you lived in a mobile home, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
As you're pointing out, a lot of people who live in those tornado alleys have plans, and it's good to have a plan of where to go in the case a tornado comes in their area. And you're right, a lot of them have it in terms of root cellars or basements. I mean, getting down low, and if you don't have a basement, then get into the interior of the house, like a closet or a bathroom are generally good structures to be in.
Closet or a bathtub?
Yeah, in the interior. Yeah, laying in a bathtub is another good thing. Don't go and open the windows. I know when I was growing up, even though I grew up in New York and you didn't have many tornadoes, we were always told that if you experience one, open the windows and that'll equalize the pressure. And it's like, well, now we realize that was kind of silly, because if you get hit, your house gets hit by a tornado, having the windows open or closed really isn't going to matter. And what you want to avoid is flying debris. And so being in front of a big glass window is generally not a good idea. Not a good idea.
Not a good idea at all. Bud, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Thanks again. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. What about the, you mentioned a mile wide.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost unbelievable to see a tornado that's a mile wide.
Yeah, yeah, and most of them are not that big. I mean, most of them, I think on average they last about 10 minutes, but they can be as short as, you know, a couple of seconds. But there have been tornadoes that last an hour or so as well. So there's a big variety in their sizes and the times that they last.
How long will they the distance they travel then is quite variable.
Quite variable as well, yeah, because some can be moving rather slowly and some may be moving as much as 60 miles per hour. So that's the thing, you never really know. So when you see one, you know, you should do something to secure yourself rather than, you know, watch them or try and outrun them because, you know, sometimes they travel in straight paths and sometimes they move around. Sometimes they'll go along and do destruction, then all of a sudden they'll just pick up and look like they're going back into the cloud, and then they come right back and form again. So it's pretty they're pretty erratic.
What are the people who chase tornadoes? I always thought were
a little bit crazy, maybe.
Yeah, apparently there were some of the chasers got in trouble this last weekend.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who do that, and some of them are, you know, real professionals and know what they're doing, and they have radars, and they know the proper direction to approach a storm. But they're still taking risks. I mean, those are still, there's still, as we were just saying, some uncertainty about the tornadoes and where they'll form.
Oh, man.
But I won't. I don't know. Maybe John's chased tornadoes, but I won't. I mean, I'm one of these guys. If it's threatening, I am going to go home.
Me too.
Right? Oh, well, let me turn your mic on there. John Martin with us. No, yeah, you're not going to chase one either?
No, man. No, sir. I've been commanded by powers that be that I cannot do that.
Otherwise known as a spouse?
Yes.
Kevin in Milwaukee has a question or comment.
Yes, I was just wondering, once a tornado has landed, has touched the ground, what are the factors that determine its path? I've seen tornadoes that just, you know, parallel a river and just seem to follow the riverbed without ever crossing. I'm just wondering what actually determines that path. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks.
I don't think we have a good idea about that. In fact, I guess it follows from the fact that we don't really have the best idea about why they actually touched down in the first place at all, in terms of a prediction and therefore a diagnosis of why they behaved in a certain way. I don't think that there are too many well-known ideas about what compels a tornado to take the path that it takes. That's a very good question. It's an outstanding one, as far as I know.
Yeah, and I guess I would add that it's probably something within the storm as opposed to something on the ground. Yeah. Like it's not going to be the riverbed or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Some emails here from Jackie in Ironwood, Michigan. Remember learning that weather generally moves from west to east. Does this have anything to do with the direction of the Earth's rotation?
Yes, it has everything to do with the Earth's rotation. That's correct. The way that the winds in the atmosphere behave, especially in the middle latitudes where we live, pays a great deal of attention to the direction of the Earth's rotation. So it's almost exactly that.
And so in other parts of the world, it might be different, or would it?
No, in the southern hemisphere middle latitudes, it'll do the same thing. So the winds will still move from west to east.
It's in
carry weather systems.
It's in the subtropics where, again, the rotation causes them at the ground to go from kind of come out of the northeast direction.
That's right, yeah.
We've got callers online, and I've got some more emails here in front of me for our guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. We'll be talking with them right up until 12:30 today about climate and weather here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Climate and weather on our minds with our guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys. Thanks for listening in today. And if you have a climate or weather question, something that's interesting for you or bugging you a little bit, maybe give us a call. The number 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And let's turn to Gail and Nina, who's been waiting a little bit. Gail, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello. My question is about lightning. My former neighborhood had a large number of lightning strike incidents. We found this out after my neighbor's house was destroyed by fire thanks to a lightning strike. All the homes were either had in-ground swimming pools or were next door or across the street from a house that did. And Nina, this neighborhood in Nina was only about two blocks from Lake Winnebago. Is there any validity to the idea that lightning is attracted to water?
Well, water is a good conductor of electricity. But, you know, if you're going to have water, like in your pools and things like that, it's going to be pretty flat and low to the ground. So I would think it would be hitting, you know, taller objects first.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe when you're near a lake, it's the few tall objects that you encounter just as you go on shore that seem to be, you know, the lightning's attracted to them. And then you could say in retrospect, boy, it seems like it's attracted to the lake. It keeps hitting things around the lake when it's actually just finding high objects because the rest of the surrounding geography is so flat, as Steve says. That might be it.
I suspected
as much, but people always want to have a parallel.
Was this one storm that did that, or was it, you know, over the years?
No, over a number of years, many of the people within about a two-block radius had reported that their televisions or electronics had been destroyed by a lightning strike.
Yeah. So having said all this, I do have to say that I've been to Nina, and it's a really nice town to live in.
So maybe it's just the tall trees, huh?
Right, yeah.
It might be.
It's not the city. They're not all the people.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Email, I'm under the impression that the South Pole is colder than the North Pole. Is this true? And if so, How much colder is it and why?
This is why Santa Claus lives at the North Pole, not at the South Pole, because it's a lot colder. And it's primarily a lot colder because it's so much higher. You know, we always talk about Denver being a mile high. Well, the South Pole is even higher than that.
Yeah, almost 2 miles high in some places. I think the pole itself is like 9,000 feet.
Feet, right, yeah. Yep.
It's way up there.
So that contributes to the coldness. And it's not atypical to find minus 70 degree temperatures.
And in addition, there's very little break in what's known as the polar vortex, that during the cold season in the South Pole, the winds circulate around the pole. They try to do this in the northern hemisphere, but there's so much difference between land and ocean contrast in the northern hemisphere high latitudes that's not there in the southern hemisphere high latitudes, that it's really hard to break down that so-called polar vortex, and that insulates the pole as really cold in the southern hemisphere. I bet you even if it weren't at such high elevation, it would be a colder pole. But because of the combination, it's really cold. In fact, we were talking off air, I think the all-time lowest temperature ever recorded on the surface of the Earth is down at Vladivostok, which was a Russian station on somewhere near the South Pole. It was minus 124 degrees there once at the surface. That's unbelievable.
Oh, man.
So don't move there. Go to Nina. It's a lot better.
Yeah, right. Take your chances with lightning.
Right.
Oh, man. Kurt in Bellevue, Iowa. We'll go to you now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. I had a question about the difference between climate and weather in relation to the volcano in Iceland.
Okay.
So if all the volcanic ash and stuff, if number one, do you think that might reduce temperatures in just Europe or the whole northern hemisphere? And if it would, and impact the growing season or something like that, would that be a climate event or a weather event? And I'm on a cell phone, so I'll hang up and take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, if it were to happen on the Northern Hemisphere scale, then I would call it more of a climate event. But it won't happen, because for that to happen, you need to get the ash and the gases that are associated with the eruption up into the stratosphere. So we're talking 6-7 miles, and it didn't get that high. And so it stayed in the lower regions of the atmosphere where it obviously caused aviation problems and weather visibility problems and things like that.
Yeah, and some agricultural problems on Iceland and maybe some adjoining land masses. But, yeah, that'll have a regional effect. And it'll be a regional weather effect, too, because of what Steve says. It just isn't going to have a global impact. But a lot of volcanic eruptions, even ones in the recent past, they do have global climatic impacts. But this one has got circumstances that'll keep it from getting on that list.
Yeah.
So there could be some local ones for Iceland and.
Yeah, I saw some pictures today that came through the Boston Globe with this large bunch of agricultural area. I think it's used for raising livestock, but there's a lot of hay that's grown in parts of Iceland, and it's just coated with dust and ash. And it's only several miles from the volcano, which really points out the fact that it gets out of the atmosphere fast when it doesn't get to high elevation. And so they'll have some pretty serious disruption to agriculture there, and probably some weather effects as well. It might be rainier or a little bit cloudier there this spring than it would be otherwise, but not really far afield.
And we have another question. In northern Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan, where I'm located, we've been in a drought, and we've talked about this on the show, but been a drought for a number of years. How many years of this would it take before we could say this is our climate? 100 or more?
That's a good question.
Really good question.
And unfortunately, you know, I went online to look, again, what the projection is for precipitation up there, and they're not looking at this drought breaking yet,
which
is really, you know, kind of frustrating, I guess, or I wish we could do something about it. But that's a good question. I don't know when you would actually say, okay, these aren't back to our normal conditions. And I guess, having said that out loud, I mean, normal conditions are usually after a 30-year period.
Yeah.
We're finishing up 2010 pretty soon. So they'll, you know, make a new 30-year period, 2010.
Back to 1980, yeah.
Yeah, so that might, I mean, if there's a real big change, maybe that'll be defined as the normal-type conditions.
Yeah, and another way to look at it using that same information might be that you might say to yourself, if it's going to take extraordinary precipitation over the next 5 years to get us back to a 30-year average, then maybe you say that is a climate perturbation, because it's just so dramatic that we can't make it up in 1 year. Yeah. But I have to say, I have no idea why that limited area of the you know, southwest side of Lake Superior should be so dry compared to the rest of the Great Lakes, the Western Great Lakes even. What's going on? It's just that it's got a target on its back. Rain, stay away. Snow, stay away.
It's like a narrow area, too.
Yeah,
it
really is.
You don't have to go very far to the east or west and north or south, and it goes away.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't really understand it.
Yeah, it's very sad, that's for sure. Stephen in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Stephen.
This could be a good segue. I hear some very disastrous and apocalyptic predictions concerning climate change and human intervention, and I'm wondering, do academic and corporate stooges who are downplaying that the possibility of what the true science says, how do you feel about what these stooges might be saying in terms of trying to calm us down in terms of climate change? Thank you so much for the conversation.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I think that this issue and it gets a pretty high profile, is really filled with a lot of noise. And I think it leaves well-meaning people wondering, who do I believe and what do I believe? And I don't have a short answer for that. I think that one way to make a decision about who to believe and what to believe is, first of all, know that nobody knows for sure what's happening in the future. But then, for my money, if I'm trying to lay a bet on what's going to happen, I'm certainly going to take the advice of 1,000 people who have spent their lives thinking about this issue and really dedicating their professional endeavor to trying to solve parts of it and talking with each other about their solutions, than I would the person who claims to be the only one of maybe a dozen people on the other side who says, I've solved the problem and I'm just kind of holding back all my answers. It just doesn't ring true to me. It doesn't mean that the 1,000 people are right. But I'd lay my money on the 1,000 people 7 days a week and twice on Sunday.
Yeah. And Steve, you would agree?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a good way to put it.
I just got another email about another book that's out about the fact that the government is made this up so that the government can socially control the people of the United States.
But I don't see any evidence that the government's socially controlling the people of the United States.
They can hardly do anything.
Yeah, right.
You can't
have it both ways. You can't, on the one hand, say that government can't do anything right except something that's Machiavellian and cloak and dagger, and it'll end up turning us all into zombies. It's totally inconsistent.
Yeah.
It's not possible to have it both ways.
Right.
Rich in East Troy. We will turn to you now. Hi, Rich.
Hey, good day, guys. Hey, I'm no electrical engineer, but on that issue with the lightning strikes around the swimming pools, could it be possible, because swimming pools have to be bonded into the ground, that the house that's grounded is somehow connected to that bonding and becomes an electrically charged system for the lightning to find it more readily?
Well, that's interesting. I know my folks' house got hit by lightning indirectly. They don't have a pool, but it did hit the ground, and then you could actually see the mark of where it traveled along the ground and got to the house and hit the main wire in the house and just, you know, blew out every electrical feature that was plugged in at the time. So that could be possible.
I'd say that if a real careful census were taken of lightning strikes in neighborhoods, maybe in particularly the ones that we heard about in Nina, it would be hard to explain away the fact, if it really turned out to be true, that certain places seem to get it more predominantly than others. It would be hard to explain it away. You'd have to find a physical cause for that. And so maybe this is a plausible physical connection.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for calling in with that idea, Rich.
And I would certainly look in that way if I noted an area that really got hit a lot. Is like electrical conductivities below the surface.
Yeah.
What about the guys that, you know, there are these individuals that are constantly getting hit by lightning?
I'd stay away from them.
Yeah, right. They have fewer and fewer friends as years go by,
right.
Especially golf buddies.
Right.
No, I don't know. How does that happen? I don't know.
Some park ranger that got hit 7 times or 8 times or something like that. I mean, it's just like, that's not a guy I'd go on a tour with.
He has a hard time making friends.
Maybe he was one of those fire ranger guys. You know, he's up in a tower. That could be, you know, account for 3 or 4 of them. But I don't know how you get the other 3.
Well, he was even hit once when he was sitting inside a car.
That's just
unbelievable. Yeah, that's Have an email conversation. Virtual friendship.
Oh, man. Frank in Port Washington, it's on to you now. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, I'm in Port Edwards, but good day, gentlemen.
Hello.
I have a question which might not be for you weather guys, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
We'll answer it anyway.
Yeah, we'll answer it anyway. Go fire away.
Well, according to my calendar, the day on which almost identically night and day occurred was March 17th, St. Patrick's Day. But it also said that the official equinox, I believe, was on March 20th. Now, how come?
Yeah, this
is a weird equation of time. Isn't there something that comes into this?
Yeah, but I think what's happening is on when they officially call the equinox, that's going to be the day when you have 12 hours daylight and 12 hours of darkness. But what might change in like on the 17th is when do you have your earliest sunrise or earliest sunset? That always seems out of sync with the 12 hours of daylight and nighttime, and it has to do with the orbit of the Earth, and I'm moving my hands here because it's really hard to describe. It's not a perfect circle and it's not a perfect ellipse. It kind of wobbles around a little bit, and we actually have an equation of time, as John was pointing to, that we can actually use to calculate it. But to explain it verbally is really, I just haven't figured out how to do that.
Yeah, I don't even understand the equation, but I've heard the story before. Yeah. It has to do with the wobble as the Earth is revolving around the sun.
Yeah.
So it's weird. It's not going to line up exactly right. But I'd not known that it was a four-day difference. That's interesting to me, and I'd like to know more about it myself.
Well, that was, the time of sunset and sunrise.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's exactly 12 hours for each one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I can't say more than Steve did, and it's interesting. I'd like to know more about it myself.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And take some more calls here. Jim and Baraboo, you're up. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi. I've always wanted to talk to a couple of meteor urologists, so this is an exciting day for me. I've got a question for you guys. I was out skiing, downhill skiing out west this past winter. It was an off snow year. And I was talking to one of the locals, and he said, "Well, go to Vail because they seed clouds there, and the snow is better." Is it true? Do they really do that?
I don't know if Vail does it. I know that I think Utah used to do it and Colorado used to do it, but I'm certain they make snow.
Yeah, they make it. I think that the seeding has been pretty much dismissed as not really working because it's hard to evaluate the experiment. If you throw things into the clouds and then you say, look, what fell out of them only came because they were seeded in, you can't run it again and say, would anything have fallen out without seeding them? So you can't really tell what the impact is in a real live test. And so I think Steve's right. I think if they're going to make snow, they might have better conditions for making good snow.
That I would think.
Dry at high elevation or whatever it might be.
As well as probably more money. Vail's pretty big ski area.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. So better equipment.
And what did they seed it with if they try to seed it?
I think the old stuff was silver iodide, but they probably went beyond that. That was discovered by Bernie Vonnegut, who was working at the GE in Schenectady, New York. And his brother, Kurt, you might have heard of, Kurt Vonnegut, he ended up writing a book later on that talked about, in Cat's Cradle, he talked about this stuff called Ice 9, which he stole from his brother Bernie. And it was anything that it touched turned to ice. And so Bernie was working in the lab and figured out that when silver iodide was dropped into a freezer, it sort of nucleated ice crystals. And they tried to simulate that in real clouds.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah. All right. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling, Jim. Gary in Rhinelander emailed... says, northern Wisconsin's north of a line from roughly Eau Claire to Wausau to Green Bay has a moderate to severe drought. Lakes going dry, lots of boats, landings unusable. When storms come from the southwest and hit this line, it's like a tomato being thrown into a brick wall and nothing gets through to us and is squeezed aside. It's been said, exclusive of El Nino, that there's an ocean anomaly somewhere that has set up a blocking high pressure in northeast Ontario that ridges back to northern Wisconsin. And this is the cause of this permanent 6 years now, high pressure.
Well, it's not really there. I think that's a little bit of a misnomer. I don't think there's been any sort of semi-permanent high over eastern and western Ontario that would have been responsible for what's going on in the northern part of our state. But I, saying that, I don't have a better explanation, except I know that's not true. I look at weather maps almost every single day of the week, so I haven't seen that. We have had, over the last few winters anyway, the winter side of the coin, we've had northwesterly flow has been the predominant flow direction for us for the last two or three winters in a row. And that is going to make most of us drier than normal, not all of us. A couple of winters in a row we haven't been, but we were this year. We joined the rest of the crowd, and that really is probably at the heart of the drought for them. Now, why the summertime or warm season precipitation has been on the low end, I would love to know the answer to that, and that's a good question. We need to start thinking about that.
Yeah, and if you look at the anomalies of precipitation this month, is it, you know, south of that line is pretty much above normal,
yeah,
and north of that line is below normal.
Yeah, and it's like, that seems to be the persistent result. I don't know why, but it does seem to be.
Joy in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Joy.
Yes, hello. It's been a long time since I've had to worry about frost, and I'm thinking of gardening this year. Can you talk, I feel as though I recollect it's not just a straight temperature thing. Can you talk about dew point and light frost, deep frost, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you'll get a frost when the, I mean, you're concerned about two things, the dew point temperature and the temperature. If the dew point temperature is above freezing, you know, and a few degrees above freezing, then you're probably not going to get frost at night.
Right.
To get frost, you need to have the dew point below the freezing temperature, and then you need to cool the air to get down to the dew point, or in which case we call it the frost point now, in order to get frost to form. And the further below freezing it is, the more damaging you can get, particularly on clear nights. I don't remember when our average frost date is, but I know my Anne, my wife, does gardening, and she was telling me this morning that there are predictions of frost in the Madison area for
next
tonight.
Couple of
nights. I would definitely look at the forecast for Madison if you've already put plants out there and they're coming above the soil to see if you should be protecting them.
Very good advice, and I think that maybe to make the what's the one thing you ought to focus on at 6 p.m. or something, watch the news, find out what the dew point temperature is then. If it's below freezing, Steve's right. You want to go out and do some protection because we're going to have clear, windless nights the next couple of nights. And if that dew point's below 27 Fahrenheit or something, pretty good chance we'll get touched with frost here and there. Maybe not everywhere, but here and there.
Yeah, particularly if it's, a lot of plants, if you hit 30 degrees, 31 degrees, you'll get frost, but it won't really damage the plant or kill the plant.
Mm.
If you're getting below 27 degrees, then that'll kill the plant. That'll be a killing frost, then it will kill the plant.
Okay.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Joy. Troy in Neillsville. Hello to you. Troy, are you there?
Hello, yeah, you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hey, I was going to say that guy that was wondering about the 12 hours of day and 12 hours of night, wouldn't you have to be on a point exactly between the North Pole and the equator for that to happen on the correct date?
No, that occurs.
Well, I'm going to ask my question and hang up and listen.
Okay.
I was wondering if about clouds. If they're all made out of ice crystals, why are some like 40,000 feet up and others are 1,200 feet up on different days? And I'll take my answer out there. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, the equinoxes are defined equinoxes because it means equal. And so everywhere on Earth on that equinox day, it occurs twice a year, there's 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of sunlight.
Yeah, that's no matter latitude or anything. And then for the clouds, it's a good question. Not all clouds are made up of ice crystals. So the ones that are really deep, the tops of those clouds, they will be ice crystals. You can even see sometimes they just seem to resist evaporation at the top of a thunderstorm cloud. It looks kind of fuzzy. And that's indication of the fact that there's a lot of ice there. But then the lower part of the same thunderstorm cloud will look very sharply defined, like cauliflower. That's all liquid water droplets. And they do not survive outside a saturated environment very long at all. They disappear. And so you can see the very sharp edges of where the cloud exists. So in Wisconsin, we always have a mixture of liquid water droplets and ice in our clouds. And so the low ones will almost always be liquid water, and the high ones will almost always have ice in them.
All right, there you have it. And Charlie, have you got a quick question? Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if I joined a little late, so I don't know if anybody talked about CO2. Why isn't that emphasized more in terms of the effect of a carbon footprint? I thought that was irrefutable that carbon dioxide was going up in the atmosphere and the oceans.
Yeah, and we've got about 30 seconds or so to answer that.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, if you look at the measurements, no matter where they're taken in the world, you'll see this continually increase of, since the industrial times of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
And that's the gas that does draw the most the high-profile concern. It's not water vapor or methane. It's carbon dioxide that draws the biggest concern in the climate problem.
Because that's the big thing we produce.
Yeah, and it lasts 100 years in the atmosphere. Once you put it in there, it's there for 100 years.
And there you have it. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Thanks, guys.
Well, thank you.
We'll be back.
Once again, you'll be back the last Monday of May.
Memorial Day.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. John Martin, Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. We'll be back on Memorial Day next month. Coming up tomorrow after 11, the Insect Kingdom. Phil Pelletieri, University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist, joins us. In the meantime, thank you for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.